All right, it's The Nose. Let me tell you who's on The Nose, then we'll tell you what The Nose is about. Joining us in studio today, Tanisha Dugan, producing associate at TheaterWorks, Rich Holland, principal and design director at CoLab, Carolyn Payne, actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, and choreographer of Kinetic Dance, and there's probably five things I left out there, too. Today on the show, a little bit later in the show, we're going to – well, actually, the beginning two segments of the show are, in some ways, about women of a certain age trying to gain mass approval. One of them is Maria Bamford in her series on Netflix, Lady Dynamite. The other one is Hillary Clinton, who's just running for president, that's all. A little later in the show, we'll also talk about the revelation that a Silicon Valley billionaire has been funding lawsuits against Gawker. And towards the end of the show, we're going to recommend some things to you. So we're going to begin with those of you. People listen to this show at various times of day and in various formats. Those of you who are just listening live here on Friday afternoon just got through hearing a Maria Bamford interview from 2013 on Fresh Air. You may be wondering, how much Maria Bamford do I have to listen to today? However, we're talking about the 2016 Maria Bamford. Her show, Lady Dynamite, is a vehicle for her. It's a vehicle for a lot of other people as well. It's partially created by Mitch Hurwitz, who I think gets to be called a certified comedy genius based on the earlier years of Arrested Development. And this is a – yeah, I'm sort of excluding the Netflix.
You know.
Maybe the way to begin is with you, Carolyn, as somebody who's working in the same field and who right away when we suggested this perked and brightened right up. For that rare public radio listener who still doesn't quite get who Maria Bamford is, what can we say? We know she's a 45-year-old actress and comedian with sun-damaged skin because we are told that so many times during the series. And she's part of a world that they call alt-comedy, although I'm never quite sure I understand who is and who isn't an alt comedian.
Well, I think the alt comedy world has sort of kind of morphed just into the mainstream comedy world, if you will. As you can tell by the guest stars on her show are all people that consider themselves to be alt comedy world but are really quite mainstream, like Mo Collins, who was on Mad TV. I think she has become very mainstream, and she's great on this. Maria Bamford, I have been a huge fan of since for several years. She used to do these great YouTube videos, and the show kind of addresses – she sort of hit her mainstream mark when she got asked to do Target commercials. And her whole life kind of – I've just been following her life, her career, and her. And this show takes all of that truth and kind of blends it with fiction. And I loved this show, and I think everyone needs to watch it. I'm a huge Arrested Development fan. Mitch Hurwitz is, I think – if I could sit down and talk with anyone or get inside anyone's brains, that he would definitely be on the list. And I think pairing the two of them for this was just brilliant.
I have had that opportunity to talk to Mitch Hurwitz at some length. And he's really, really funny, and he's really, really brilliant. In fact, I'm going to brag now. One of the thrills of my life is I did the Connecticut Forum with him, and I usually do a little bit of kind of stand-up before they get out there. And then during the intermission, he came up to me and goes, "What was that joke you told? Tell me that joke again." That was so Mitch Hurwitz is asking me that. And I couldn't remember awesome. Which – I didn't know which joke he was talking about. But anyway, so
– that is worth a brag.
Yeah, that is worth a brag.
So, Rich, this – you know, I think of Slaughterhouse-Nine. Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time. This show is very unstuck in time. There are at least three different time levels to it. But not only that, there are multiple levels of reality. Even when you feel as though in the early going, you understand how many levels of reality there are. This is a comedian doing a show about doing a comic show, but also fantasizing about commercials that she might be in, but which really don't exist. We're starting to get adjusted to all this. And then we see a bench that she's set up in her neighborhood, hoping that her neighborhood will become more communal. People will sit down on this bench. A cop comes by. It's Patton Oswalt, another alt comedy star. Here's what happens then.
Do you have a permit for the community bench?
No. Is that required?
It is. And if you don't have one, you're going to have to go down to City Hall and get one. Or I can write you a 4950. I don't want to write you a 4950.
I can't do it right now. I've got to get ready for a stand-up gig. But
invite him.
Maybe.
Look at that helmet. That's a good-shaped head, if you know what I mean.
Would you want to come to a comedy show? They're so wonderful.
Oh, God. Maria, I'm sorry. You, come here. You're going to put stand-up in your show?
Yeah, I mean, is that bad?
It's bad. It is bad. It's been done so many times before. You know, you got Louis, Seinfeld, Chappelle, Amy Schumer, my two pilots. No, they didn't go.
I'm so sorry. We haven't officially met. Are you the comedy police?
I'm a friend giving friendly advice.
Well, you're also an actor, so just say your lines, monkey.
You're an actor, so just say your lines, monkey. So, Rich, we are playing three-level chess here in time and three-level chess in another set of dimensions in terms of reality. And that's already happening by the time that Patton Oswalt shows up and then announces his own meta take on everything that's happened so far.
Absolutely. And that was this whole piece, all four episodes I've watched, felt a little like Inception, where every time you walk through a room, you're in a whole other dimension and you never know when that transition is actually taking place.
Which is another howlingly funny property. But anyway, keep going.
Yeah, right. The comic Inception. The interesting thing about breaking this fourth wall is you're never really sure if that's what's happening while it's happening. It could be intentionally speaking about the show itself, or it could be speaking about the show itself. And there's a piece of that was initially disorienting to me up until that one moment, that one clip that you played, in which the reality that I was living was lining up with the reality that the show was presenting, because I was thinking the same thing, you know, just seconds before he stated that.
I guess
thinking, really, stand up?
I don't know what's wrong with
Louis do that too?
my weird mind, but I didn't. I was following it. You know, I guess it's just how my mind works. As I was kind of with her on this journey,
yeah.
Even, you know, up to that point. And I think that point, because I was watching it with a friend, and that was when he had the aha moment of like, oh, okay, so we're just all over the place here. But I had picked up on this multilinear. I liked the scheme of this because I think that is what was making this different for me.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a thing that I actually really loved about this, Caroline. Now, truth be told, when I watched the first two episodes, I did not like this thing at all. It was my wife and I were watching it together, and she just kept asking me to explain what the heck is going on, you know, which challenges it, and why Colin made us watch it.
Why is the nose making you watch this show?
Exactly. Why are we going to do this? And please let this be just a half an hour show. But what happened after that is, you know, I was going to give it another shot because it was starting to get kind of interesting for me. And what I did was I did what the audience is going to have the benefit of doing by listening to the show, is getting a little bit of background on who she was. I had no idea who this one was, what her arc was. And so to look at it again with an understanding of that arc, all the pieces started to fit together in a way that I could just surrender trying to understand it and just go for the ride.
Now, Tanisha, I had a slightly different set of reactions in the sense that really that Patton Oswalt moment, that was my worst moment, where I was where I was ready to bail. And
how can you bail an Officer L'Amour? Come on.
I think because, okay, that was sort of one layer too many for me, or one piece of meta-ness too many for me. And my question about this show still is, I feel like I'm watching some very, very funny performances, mm-hmm. and I feel like I'm watching some tremendous comedy material, but I feel like it's constantly in danger of drowning from its own ambitions mm-hmm. to be so much more than a half-hour comedy show.
I think you're spot on, and that was sort of my experience of it. It sort of reminded me of the fact that, like, the comedy shows that I like are really like classic family situation. Like, I'm a Carmichael Show kind of gal. This doesn't really float my boat. And it wasn't until the later episodes where I started to really like get into who this character was, which subsequently I actually went backwards. I watched the episodes first and then read, mm-hmm. That I learned that this was semi-autobiographical. And that was interesting to me because now I'm watching some psychology play out in a way that's like human and personal and touching, and I could appreciate the characterization in a different way. I just, like, as soon as I watched it, I was like, oh, this is like Amy Sedaris. Like, that's who she is. Okay. And I think Amy Sedaris is a better Amy Sedaris. That was like my original my first sort of thoughts about it when I saw it.
Yeah, I think we're seeing it the same way, though, Tanisha. By the time it got to episode 3 and 4, mm-hmm. The setup, you know, all the setup that they needed to do in the first two episodes to set up what Duluth is really about, what past,
right.
present, you know, all
right.
the... All the tense changes, the place changes.
What shade of sepia will we use?
Exactly. You know, by the so they set all that up in the first two episodes, yeah. and you know, and it was a little tedious. But by the time it got to the third episode, we hung in with an idea a little longer, and certainly by the fourth episode, it was really about this idea of mm-hmm. of character and what we'll do for approval versus what
exactly.
we'll do for authenticity.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
becomes interesting.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like a lot of us are having the same reaction. I found the 3 and 4, Carolyn, really redeemed the series a lot because, in fact, I could stay, as Rich is saying, with an idea a little bit longer in episode 4 just to give people a slight sense. Maria kind of accidentally discovers this kind of low, throaty voice that she can do, this sexy woman named Diane, who people seem to like a lot better than they like her, which she finds it difficult to sustain. But she's getting rewarded not only by the attentions of a very handsome man, but in other ways. And it kind of culminates with her being offered a lot of this series, and this is probably the area where Carolyn feels she can relate a lot to, are moments in which Maria is either offered or invited to compete for jobs in show business, which are sort of humiliating or just badly, badly flawed. And in this case, there's this incredibly misogynist game show or reality show that involves locking women up in boxes. lock up abroad, and they want her to be the host of it, but only if she will speak in this particular voice. And that sort of is the moment where she kind of maxes out on this question of how much am I willing to completely distort myself. But as somebody who auditions a lot, and somebody who's sort of aware of a lot of programs and ideas and commercials in development that maybe a lot of us don't get to see because they were such bad ideas in the first place, this must seem less surreal to you than it strikes us as.
Yeah, I think I definitely was relating to this show on a whole different level than probably everyone else in this room. And I that's one of the things like I latched on to right away was how her interactions, that very handsome man that she lures in by talking in this low, throaty, like very like Connecticut waspy voice she has of this alter ego she's developing, which she develops because she's going to a dinner party and doesn't want – she's hates having to interact with people. And that's something that I actually get. I have been in situations where I've thought, like, you know, I'll just make up who I am entirely right now. And scary enough, I've done it.
Do you lose the thread?
That to me is like the meditation on a creative life and a working creative life. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is the parallels that she's playing with, because the insecurity that she has as a human being that she then places on these characters is like what I deal with every day when I talk to artists. It's essential to being able to create the art. And now she's
opening up like right. that behind the scenes curtain.
Exactly.
And yes, it's like it's uncomfortable and it's weird, but there's just this great beauty in it because you see who she is as an artist. And I thought one of the funniest things in that episode that I could relate to is this guy when she's saying like, let's be real. And she returns to her own voice. And he says that one of his confessions of being real is that he hates the sound of laughter and has no sense of humor.
Well, this is work,
and you know, it just like for a comedian where you're just right. so much of your value of yourself is based on being funny, to be sitting there with a guy who's like, oh, the sound of laughter, like just the look on and her expressions and reactions are just priceless. And this show in that way reminded me, I know that Colin, you mentioned in emails this week, The Comeback, which is another one of my...
Actually, Rich started that, but yes.
Yes.
So this is the Lisa Kudrow vehicle.
Yes. And I loved that show. I was so
Same
glad
here.
When it got its comeback. I thought that was just such a brilliant, and unlike Lady Dynamite, that was not as autobiographical, but it was kind of that other, another very flawed female comedian, like behind, you know, behind the Oz curtain. And also going back even further was Fat Actress with Kirstie Alley. I thought was another really brilliantly funny and raw, sometimes kind of uncomfortable to watch, but great, great show.
You know, I do feel like the miss in this piece, though, and I saw all the buzz before you had asked us to watch it. It was sort of like everywhere and on the sites that I read. And I think it's an inside job. Like, it's an insider's comedy show. I don't know, and maybe that's just my take on it, but I don't know if it's really...
It certainly is speaking. I had the same sense that I wasn't always included in all the jokes. I think there were enough so that I did feel included. But, Rich, I also... I'm turning to the design guy for a second, too, because... I also felt one difference between this and The Comeback and Fat Actress or anything else, there's just a lot of production in this.
This thing,
the budget for this thing, I can guarantee you, is five times the per episode budget of The Comeback or anything like it. There's just a lot of stuff that goes on. I will quickly say that although I kind of toggled back and forth in terms of how funny this was, the whole show was, I almost needed oxygen when one of the episodes began with a Japanese commercial for a product called Pussy Noodle, which is a ramen.
Oh, we can say that?
Yeah, you can say Pussy Noodle. You can say Pussy Riot. You can say, but yes, yeah, it was a ramen product. It was like this bizarre, distorted, violent, upsetting commercial for a ramen and a cup product. I was also aware
that they steam.
Yeah, and I googled it and made the whole thing that much more disturbing.
But they didn't, you know, they spent a lot of money just making that commercial.
But the beauty of it now is we can make things like this pretty inexpensively, right? As long as you don't have to appease a client.
Right. So when Mira Sorvino's car takes off, they did that.
No, that's cheap. I have an app on my phone that can do that.
It's called Snapchat. Yeah.
Tanisha, to me, one of the other questions that I had was, how Pirandello do I need my comedy to be? Back to your point about how... In some ways, you would just like it sort of straight up. You just tell me a story and stick to it. And certainly there is a scene, I think it's in the fourth episode, or third episode, I guess, when Mira Sorvino, who is on as a guest at the end, she kind of ticks through the levels at which she's been performing. She's supposedly a British actress playing another British actress playing an American role. And then Maria says, well, there's Mira Sorvino. And she goes, oh, am I, you know, or suggesting that flies away in her car. And
with
there's a
glitter.
Way in which every time this series sets a table for us, mm-hmm. somebody comes on and grabs the tablecloth and whips it out from underneath all the glassware on it. And after a while, I was sort of feeling like, well, just stick to it. Just stay with this for a little while. You don't have to upend your own premise every 2 seconds.
Yeah, I am not a comedian by trade, and so I guess some of the craft is lost on me, and it looks just really crafty, I think, is my – separate from the story, because I think that there is a story that she's telling about what it means to do the work that she does and how she got there and how she continues to get there. But I'm not. I'm sort
all
of like
the heavy interaction with her manager and the
Anna Gasteyer. Totally makes me feel like what's her name? I'll eat you last. What's her name? Sue Mangers. She's total like a Sue Mangers ripoff.
Yeah. Anna Gasteyer.
Anna Gasteyer plays one of several women on the series whose name is Karen Grisham.
Yeah.
Karen Grisham. There are three different characters named Karen Grisham. The main one, the one you see the most, is Anna Gasteyer, who is this dragon lady whose slogan we cannot repeat on the air. So we may be able to talk about ramen products, but there are other things that we cannot
Can
say.
Can we sing her theme song?
But her,
probably not.
Her whole – but well, actually, speaking of theme songs, one of the things that comes up, Carolyn, on this show, and this is something I do want to get to before we lose the chance, is that –
I don't know what I'm doing nearly half of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's sort of that.
That's a theme song?
No, yeah, that's the their outro. The outro is my favorite.
And there's – I know I should have written it down or put it in the document, but there's also this whole thing about it's better to have 9 people really love you than 9,000 people kind of like you. And to me, this is a series both in terms of how we're digesting it and in terms of what it thinks about sort of the long tail phenomenon, right? You know, do you want to be incredibly popular? Do you want to be Brett Butler, if that's what her name is, in Grace Under Fire, and have everybody know who you are but not care about you at all, you know? Or do you want to be
– you could even pull up her name.
There's a reason for that. But or do you want to be somebody that fewer people know about but care passionately about, which seems to be the – I think one thing that we're all reacting to here is comedy has become so diverse. There's so many platforms for it. You
can
pick out the thing.
That bespoke comedy.
Yeah, you can pick out the thing that's exactly right for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think this show, I don't know if anyone else here was a huge Arrested Development fan at the beginning. See, and that's the point. You probably just didn't give it the chance. And back then, it didn't get launched on a platform like Netflix where you could go back and rewatch it. And this show, I did go back and rewatch it because Netflix is one of those shows that I put on as like a sleepy time show and fall asleep to still. And just because – and it's one of those – you every little joke that you missed the first or the second or even the third time, they just build and it becomes funnier the more you watch it. And I will say that, you know, having the same writer and the way that they've developed these characters and the way it's written, go back and watch it. Take us like go back and freeze it on a screen. Like when you see the dating profiles, go back and read those. I mean, there's just layers of little details here that are there to be appreciated on, you know, like there's like little secrets all throughout.
Let me just interject because I got it wrong the first time, though. The great song in the title of the show says, I'd rather be nine people's favorite thing than 100 people's ninth favorite thing. That's kind of the sentiment that they're going for.
When I was in film school, the big challenge was to never expose the medium. Like, we should not be aware, you know, that we're watching a film. We should be transported beyond that. And as soon as everybody got comfortable with that theory, we automatically started throwing it against the wall to see what happens, right? And then you get to Oliver Stone making a thing like JFK or Natural Born Killers where it's all about the high visibility of the medium, of, you know, of the director's hand and the director's grasp of, you know, of what he's working with. And so I think that we're at a point now where we could actually be comfortable with that, right? So it's not jarring us in terms of saying like, oh my God, this is new and I'm not ready for it. It's, oh, this is that, and do I feel like having it?
Yeah.
Very quickly, just because – so the third episode does veer into the whole question of race. I have to say at the beginning that I apologized in a way to Tanisha that she didn't get to be on the Beyonce version episode of The Nose, but she had to.
That was sad.
I did not either.
She had to do this white lady comedians thing here.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I did,
feigned my interest. No, just kidding.
Well, I quoted Kimmy Schmidt to you. There's sort of a moment in Kimmy Schmidt where she's talking to an African American woman who's a GED teacher, and Kimmy says, "Well, Dong and I were kind of the Roz and Fraser of our GED class," and she makes a reference. Is it to Maxine
like Kyle and Maxine?
She goes, "Well, I know I've got a kind of Kyle and Maxine thing with my boss." Kimmy looks at her blankly, and this woman says, "Oh, you don't know Living Single, but I'm supposed to know all about Fraser."
And my response to him was dead with the laughing cry face because it's so true.
But so this in the third episode, in fact, they do go there. They do talk quite a lot about race. We do, first of all, see Kimmy. We see Maria at the pool with this black character who has surfaced in a whole other context that I can't even begin to describe to you, but which is also very funny. And so here's the back and forth between them.
What's the matter? Black man can't be in the pool? Want to call the mayor, have him drain it?
No. It's just that we've been running into each other, and now you're here, you know?
I'm just kidding.
Oh. Oh, my God. Oh, I have a... I love humor. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I did. I was scared there for a second.
Why? Because I'm black?
No.
I was kidding again.
Oh, my God. Oh
you really
God.
Need to lighten
That's
up.
That's good.
Like I wish I could God. Do, but I'm black.
I don't know. Am I supposed to laugh at that?
Depends if you're racist or not.
Do you think I'm racist? Is asking that racist?
There's no right answer. Things aren't black and white. Or are they?
Oh no.
I'm going to start messing with people exactly like that.
Yeah. Oh, no.
But if you like that kind of humor, by the way, this is early for endorsements, but listen to Anthony Mackie's interview on The Nerdist. He has them up against the ropes for pretty much however long the show is in exactly that way. And it's I don't know. What did we think of this particular episode? Actually, I'll just take the extra moment and throw to – this is a subsequent conversation between Kimmy and her manager. We mentioned him a few times. He's played by Fred Melamed. Is that his name? They have a very funny relationship. He's a very, very funny character. She starts talking to him, or he starts talking to her, about one of these really bad idea projects.
It's a sitcom, easy hours, you'd be home every day by 4, stupid money. Plus, I remember you saying you wanted to have more diversity in your life. Well, get this, it's a black show. The leads of these two black comics, you can't tell one from the other.
Bruce.
No, they're twins.
Oh. No, I would like to have more diversity in my life. I'm just worried about everything I do or say lately, racially.
Oh, are you racist?
No. Do I seem like a racist?
No, of course not. Do I?
No.
Well, let's see what our old friend Ask Jeeves has to say about it. Chantrell?
Yeah?
Ask Jeeves if there are any groups in the L.A. area for people who hate being racist.
I don't hate being racist. That's...
You should.
Okay, how about this? Are you nervous? You're a full-blown racist.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are your ethnic friends annoyed that you ask too many questions about race? Bring your questions about black people and other minorities to LA Pure. People united for racial equality.
That's exactly what I need. A group to talk about racial issues.
I knew Chantrell could handle your issues decor. She does, after all, possess the name of a black lady. Chantrell!
What?
Nothing, my sweet.
So
she's Asian.
So, Tanisha, all of this is very funny, but it really is very much funny as the white person's problem with racism as opposed to the black person's problem with racism.
Amen, brother. This is exactly my – I was actually shocked that I made it to 4 and 4 made me start 5. But that episode I was like, really? I don't want to hear your struggles dealing with black people. I don't think it's funny. But there I am in my box again. So, you know.
Although it was rich in attempting to make fun of a white person's struggles with their struggles about racism.
It didn't get there.
And that's exactly what my point was, what my point would be as well. That, you know, that you can pack that box so layered, like those little Russian doll things, that that you actually never get to the heart of it. And this one wanted a
you want
to give me a little taste of the resolution on this one, you know,
and
or
John
at
Ridley,
the very least
they never, and they even addressed it at the end that like it just, you know, did they get anywhere with this? No, I don't think they did. And I
but
thought that
it's
that
like
was,
I don't think they did, but let's just, you know, go down the street in a on the end of a garbage truck, like we're a scene from The Wiz or something, you know, and
but
it
I think
just
that,
doesn't really quite play.
Like
out.
Leaving it there, like, oh, we didn't get anywhere.
But you know, the piece
is like
me,
the thing that I think yeah. makes people
right.
feel comfortable.
And it's less about.
I'm going to have to just wrap this up because we will have time. We'll have talked about nothing but Maria Bamford, and then Hillary Clinton will not be elected president. So we have to take a break, and we'll come back. All right, we're back. We've been talking about Lady Dynamite, which is the new series for Maria Bamford on Netflix. And now we're going to talk about Hillary Rodham Clinton, and we're not going to talk about the state of her campaign. And, you know, that would have been a good name. That would have been a good theme. They didn't think of it. But there are other ways in which there are some interesting what we call Papoulian through lines as we make this transition. There is a little bit of Hillary and Maria and vice versa. Episode 4 of Maria revolves around Maria trying to invent a version of herself that seems to please people more. This seems to be just an ongoing quest for Hillary Clinton. So this week, David Brooks wrote a column saying, "Why is Clinton disliked?" That's the title. He says, "I would begin my explanation with this question. Can you tell me what Hillary Clinton does for fun? We know what Obama does for fun, golf, basketball, et cetera. We know, unfortunately, what Trump does for fun. But when people talk about Clinton, they tend to talk about her exclusively in professional terms, blah, 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 about how she's multitask-oriented, organized, deceptive. Her career appears from the outside to be all consuming. Her husband is her co-politician. Her daughter works at the Clinton Foundation. Her friendships appear to have been formed at networking gatherings reserved for the extremely successful." So, I mean, Rich, one question I have is, once again, is Clinton being held to some kind of different standard, or is she being held to the same standard that politicians often are held to? Romney didn't seem like he ever had fun.
No.
Al Gore didn't seem like he ever had fun. It can be kind of a problem for you if you don't seem like you ever have fun.
Absolutely. It seems like one of the first tests of being president of late is, are you a guy I want to have a beer with, or a person that I want to have a beer with? And so the ability to, you know, to be interesting, to be able to relate to others, to be able to connect around common interests seems to have been for better or worse, and we could talk about that later, an institutional part of our American politics right now. Now, there is – I say right now, but I don't think it is right now. I think it's always kind of been a bit like that. I mean, when I think about appeal issues between Nixon and JFK, that was at play. Do we feel like we know something about JFK that makes us trust the guy? You know, so he plays football with the family, and, you know, and there are some cues that we feel like he's going to, that he might be advocating for the same things that I might be advocating for. Those seem to be important in our political structure. And though we're talking about Hillary Clinton, I think that, you know, Bernie Sanders has the same challenge. You know, I have no idea what he's into or what he does, though he did lay some claim to grandparenthood, which Hillary Clinton also laid some claim to. And you got the sense that they could connect on those levels. But beyond that, we seem to crave more, and that also seems to be that kind of calculated vulnerability, that ability, that willingness to expose a piece of self seems to be a piece of how we define leadership right now.
Although, you know, Tanisha, well, I guess just to, for the fun of it, push back at that. I mean, I think about 2008. I'm not sure how much of the fun of candidate Barack Obama, was evident at that time. And certainly the argument that was being made was that both Obamas had to prove their excellence in a way that that other candidates and other political families didn't have to. You really didn't have to be as good as everybody else. You had to be better. You had to prove in all ways that you were better. And I wonder whether Hillary Clinton is subjected to the same thing, that she, because she would be the first something, she has to demonstrate her excellence all the time. And then as kind of the final insult, we say, oh, also, are you fun? You've been killing yourself to prove that you are absolutely as good and as proficient and tough and uncompromising and unflinching as every other male politician.
I think there is some of that. But I also think that there's a bit of, you know, with the Obamas, we could put on them what we imagined that kind of person to find fun. And I don't think that Hillary is the same kind of body. You know, like, we can project what we think the Obama's household would be like. We can, and when we hear, oh, he listens to this kind of music or he does that kind of thing, we can create an entire life around that that satisfies our curiosity of what the behind the scenes version of that person would look like. She is so blank. And I think that speaks to this idea of excellence, right? That she's removed any kind of personality from even her delivery, that it's hard to project an idea of who you think she could be and fill in those blanks for yourself, which I think is part of what makes it difficult to like her.
She's been in the public eye for so long that I think that it is kind of remarkable that she's lived in the White House where, you know, and she's been somebody that you think you would know so well by now. But I think there have been glimpses. There have been these moments that for me have been these like aha moments that I've kind of like fallen in love with her as a person. Like I was just Googling quickly to make sure that I got it. But she, in 2012, when she was like in Africa, she was dancing on, she like got up on the dance floor and was like all like into it. And it, when you watch that video, I remember watching that and being like, wow, okay, Hillary, yeah, I will go out and have a drink with you and we can hang out. But it's just those like little, there have been these moments along the way where I think you really see who she is, but I think she is guarded because I think she's afraid. And I think
she works really hard to deny them because, yeah. I mean, you brought up the Bernie Sanders grandparent point. There's nothing more perfect for her to embrace than the fact that her daughter is about to have another child and to visibly show her excitement,
right,
and thrill of that life change, right? Because that's the thing I think that connects her to other working women, this idea that your family life lives in tandem with your career. If she were to show that that actually had as much value as her running for president, I think she would – that would immediately make her more likable to
sure.
most of the country. But
absolutely.
this complete distance from the fact that there is, like, a life-changing thing happening within her family's, you know, environment is – just odd.
And, you know, and frankly, when I saw it come up recently, the grandparent thing, it came up strategically, not intimately. You know, it came up as a positioning against Sanders trying to claim the grandparent card.
She needs Olivia Pope.
Well, I think that
yeah.
she needs the
I think on that point
to come in.
That I'm sure that there's a part of her, because, like, when you think of a grandmother – mm-hmm. Like, you know, you think of, like, I think she's thinking that people are going to think, you know, knitting yes. in a rocking chair, you know, just kind of like that image. And I think she is trying.
But she's a boomer.
To,
and there's like a butt ton of boomers in her place.
I am not arguing that, but I think.
My parents are boomers and they are not about to like hop into the grave because they have a grandchild. And they would love to see somebody who is like, I am vibrant. I am alive. My brain still works. I still want to do, you know.
I do. I think that maybe I sense another Papoulian through line here, too, between these two things. And it's the issue of self-consciousness. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, with Maria Bamford sort of asking that Pirandellian question, what happens when the characters are aware that they're characters? And one of the problems that Hillary Clinton has labored under is, more than almost any public figure that I can remember, a constant sense that we have that she's aware of the situation that she's in and aware of the questions that are constantly
yes.
being asked about her. So this week, we all know, who can make anything better? Ellen! That's where you go. Ellen will make anything better. So in one episode of Ellen DeGeneres' daytime show this week, she tried to deal with the problems that people have had that we've talked about in the past with the whole idea of a female Ghostbusters reboot and Hillary Clinton. They were both on. The female cast of Ghostbusters and Hillary Clinton were both on as Ellen tried to make it all better. But what I saw was what I see all the time, too, which was, you know, Hillary Clinton was given a kind of a pop culture game to play at the end. Mm. She played it very well. She was sort of a would-you-rather kind of thing to pick running mates, and she could kind of drool over Tony Goldwyn or whatever, and she kind of got how to do all that. But, you know, I think you're doomed. Any of us is doomed when you reach that level of self-consciousness. You know, whether you're thinking about, you know, the act of sex while you're having sex or trying to do your signature while you're making your signature, the way to wreck anything is
sure.
to be really aware that you're doing it and how anybody else might be regarding you while you're doing it. And I think she's in that hell that she can't get out of.
Yeah, and the way you get out of that hell, and I'm sure everybody here has been there every time I've gotten up to do a presentation, I've gotten there, and I'm sure as performers, you've gotten there. And you take a big, huge, stinking risk, and you reach in for something that's authentic, and you dare to share. And that's challenging. If I could take a look at this thing that Sanders was up against when they kept pushing him on his religion. You know, they were pushing. The guy could not get away from that question fast enough until the one time that he just kind of felt cornered by it and just like spewed a thing out that felt authentic and boy, answered the question.
And
you know?
It's a craft. I mean, Carolyn and I
yes.
both went to conservatories. We learned the art of being authentic in public. It's a craft, and she's got the resources to learn it. Because I swear to you, it could be the dividing line for her as we move into the general, because that's the one thing that Trump can do without a question is to give us the feeling of authenticity,
yes.
whether that is actually
yeah.
him or not.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for including the feel.
And that matters. And
yeah.
so she needs a little bit of actor artist training because
absolutely.
It's important. It's important.
I almost want her to just cut loose. Like, totally. Like, I would love for her to just get embarrassingly drunk and just be put out in a situation where she loses all inhibition. And then, you know, I think once she drops that guard, the beauty of Elizabeth Warren's tweets,
you know, Elizabeth Warren's tweets, because she's tweeting, feels like an authentic moment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And when I see her speak, she feels authentic as well. The other challenge that that HRC is facing is the comparative challenge. Is that that we're not just looking at her in a vacuum any longer. We're looking at her compared to other stuff, and now authenticity isn't just is it there or is it not a checklist type of thing, but it's how is it compared to other forms of authenticity and. What does that really mean to your role as potential president of the United States?
I want to read one quick tweet here from Red Menace. She writes, yes, much of political media values authenticity and other intangibles over competence. Competence is boring, no page clicks. Although what I would say back to that, though, is I mean I feel as though she's kind of losing on both fronts these days. There's a sense that, first of all, the campaign itself has not been all that efficiently or competently run, that they badly misjudged the problems they were going to have with Sanders, that she's really had trouble pulling away from him. And she's also living with the problem. I mean obviously this week the Solicitor General report on the email servers. I mean, a competent person would know better than to do something like that. We would forgive somebody for something like that if we had a more authentic relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the problems. She gets no slack cut for her because of this. I just very quickly, Carolyn, as we finish here and get ready for our endorsements, I mean, it is always interesting to watch what the world of comedy does with somebody. And obviously, the indelible impersonation of Hillary Clinton from this campaign is going to be Kate McKinnon. And it's an almost exclusively a very Nietzschean characterization. There's was a moment on one of the recent shows where she and Bernie Sanders, a.k.a. Larry David, are in a bar and they really have been drinking. They've been drinking. They're kind of drunk. They're going to wind up dancing. But at one point, she kind of slumps her head a little bit down on the bar as if she's had one too many. And she goes, let me tell you something about me that nobody knows, you know, a little something. He goes, yeah, I want to know something about you that other people don't know. And she goes, I really want to be president. and that's the Kate McKinnon take on her, right? She just is this instrument of will.
I actually hadn't seen that sketch yet, but that's exactly what I am picturing. That is what I'm saying, that we need Hillary to do to kind of – so maybe it's not a bad idea for her. Maybe she should just –
well, somehow
I think she should have a beer with Carolyn.
Her story is so human. I mean, if you look at her story between the husband and the staying married and the – you know, and the fight to get through Yale as a woman and to become you know, leader of the free world. I mean,
right, everything
with
about
the exception
her,
of that piece.
When you put it that way,
exactly.
And
the exception
actually,
of that
yeah.
piece.
And I give her
human.
In terms of the likability factor, I give her a lot of slack, a lot of leeway for being married to Bill Clinton. This is a guy that could do like a tremendous amount, just about anything wrong and still be a likable dude.
Right. Okay,
you know, and that's a hard thing to sit with.
We're going to have to wrap this up, too. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to recommend a few things to you.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and our intern is Leah Myers. The part of Phil Curry was played by Justin Timberlake. For show pages, articles, and photos, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. We'll be back on Tuesday with a full show interview with On Being's Krista Tippett. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, just very quickly, that's true. We're going to take the holiday off, and there's going to be a holiday special for you. We'll be back on Tuesday. And I've actually already had this conversation with Krista Tippett, and I don't know if she's anybody that you follow in terms of her show, On Being. I really like this interview. I'm hoping that people like it as much as I do. I think the one person that you don't know as a result of listening to On Being or Speaking of Faith is Krista Tippett, but you will know her at the end of this much better. Anyway, time to endorse or recommend things. We'll start with Carolyn Payne. What have you got for us?
Oh, boy. I was trying to Google.
Oh, no, okay. Here. We'll start with Rich Holland.
Okay. So the first endorsement is for Connecticut Children's Medical Center. This is a shout-out that's going out from all of us here on the panel today to our friends, the Salazars, whose daughter got into a very significant accident And I've been at children's at CCMC a number of times with my own kids, and I'm taking a look at the care that these folks are giving to this couple and their daughter, and big huge gratitude to that hospital. And if there's any way you could think to support them, do so.
They get my little preemie peanut alive, so
right on.
It's a good place.
Next shout out goes to this past week. I've been getting caught up on these great recordings of gratitude that was actually put together by NPR and the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving. It's called Words to Give By at wordstogiveby.org. You should jump on and take a listen. These are super inspiring, quick little stories from all kinds of folk. Today, I was on the homepage and I noticed that there is a lovely photo of Kyone Wolf, as I'm sure all photos are of Kyone Wolf, telling a great little one-minute story of her relationship to her mom. So go take a listen, be inspired, do some good.
All right, Words to Give By and CCMC. All right, what have you got for us, Tanisha?
What do I got for
We're
us?
Giving Carolyn well, maximum amount.
Well, I got a co-sign on both of those that Rich brought up today, and Miss Kyone, and the giving. It's a nice moment in your work day if you need a little pick me up. In the meantime, it's the it's kickoff, unofficial kickoff to summer. So Powder Ridge is doing a food festival, food truck festival tomorrow, which I'm excited about. All of our favorite regional food trucks will be in the building or on the slopes, I guess is a better way. And because this is always the first place we go when summertime kicks off, Angelico's in East Hampton. Looking forward to spending some time over there this weekend.
All right, Carolyn, are you ready?
I am. Thank you for that extra second there. Okay, I wanted to check the date. So Pipo, which is a website started by Stephanie Lang, who was a producer and director of Veep. She started this comedy website, and it's kind of all female-driven comedy. And they are doing a show with female comedians and stand-ups in Boston this Sunday night. I will not be there because I am rehearsing for a show up in the Berkshires, but you should go if you are a fan of comedy and want to see some like really great up-and-comers. This website, just check out the website, Pipo, P-Y-P-O, and go see this show. You might see the next, like, Maria Bamford. It's just great. I know I have some good friends who are in the show, and definitely go.
All right. Another thing that you can do that involves a live performance is to go and see The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd that's being done right now at the Norma Terrace Theater, which is the developmental part of Goodspeed Musicals. Now, The Roar of the Grease Paint doesn't really have to be developed. It was produced, I think, in 1965 in New York on Broadway. It has this amazing story. It's the brainchild of Anthony Newley. Anthony Newley was this brilliant songwriter. You know a lot of his songs, whether you realize it or not. What Kind of Fool Am I is probably the most famous, unless you count Candyman. He wrote all the music for Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And he was kind of this kind of odd career in a way. He had kind of a music hall sound and also a great sophistication. And he had the misfortune, I think, of having that musical sound come to prominence right at the moment when the Beatles had made it less cool and right before the Beatles started to make it really cool again with Sgt. Pepper. But anyway, Roar of the Grease Paint is a remarkable post-apocalyptic staging down there in Chester. It looks like it looks kind of like Mad Max the musical, and it's a bunch of the Mad Max the musical, either that or Waiting for Godot the musical with, I don't know, special concentration on Lucky and Pazzo or something. I don't really know what it is, but there are these amazing songs. Once again, songs that you probably know, including Who Can I Turn To, Feeling Good, which got turned into a Nina Simone classic. You hear it right now on, I think, Virgin Airline commercials or something. The Joker, which was recorded by Sergio Mendes and Bobby Rydell and all kinds of other people. So these are songs in many cases that you'll know, that you'll hum along to, and it really is a great performance. Chester is an incredibly adorable place to go, especially around this time of year. So you can go have a quick dinner at the River Tavern or the Good Elephant, where they've kind of converted to Vietnamese cuisine with a tang of Frenchness instead of the other way around. So you can have a wonderful meal there and then spend a wonderful evening. This really is a fun show. It's not for everybody. It's, I mean, they have changed the staging of it. In 65, it was this very abstract and psychedelic show. They've done something very different with it, and not everybody's going to be knocked out by it. But if you love the music and you're willing to kind of, you know, roll with the premise a little bit, you'll have a great time. So The Roar of the Grease Paint, that's my endorsement. And thanks once again to Tanisha Dugan and to Carolyn Payne and to Rich Holland. And we will be back on Tuesday with Krista Tippett. Two P's and two T's. Remember that. All the berry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.